Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. I think we should get like some music. We really deserve music. Please, can you bless us with some music? Like we need a startup like theme, something.
So, Letlokonolo, I don't know about blessing you guys with music. I know my voice is just an absolutely amazing. I know you think I can do all things. I don't know if I can sing the theme song for the Cheeky Natives, but just stay tuned. Black girls be making it happen, so stay tuned. But I'm so excited for today's conversation. I read this book on a business trip somewhere, and I was just overwhelmed by the sort of performance that you have to do in corporate South Africa. And I read this book and literally a breath of fresh air. I messaged the Tokonola and I was like, babes, whatever you do, you must read the book. Whatever you do, you must read the book. And so I have the great pleasure of introducing our guest today, Nozuko Siyothula, who is currently working abroad and who is the author of Christopher, which was a finalist in the Dinan Debut Fiction Award in 2020, and who is our guest today. So welcome, Nozuko, to the Cheeky Natives.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited. Happy to be here. I love you guys' platform. I actually wanted this interview the most because I was like, I really did, because I just think you love books the way I love books. You jam about them the way I jam about books with other people. And so to be appreciated really by this community, it's tops for me.
I was really interested in like the cover of the book, right? And I wanted to know if there's any significance to the cover of the book, because I know that the story places quite a lot of emphasis on like family and intergenerational like branching, so to say. And so I looked at the cover and I was like, I wonder if this is like the like remembrance of like a family tree and like connections and stuff like that. So I thought I'd ask you the question about the cover because that's really what interested me.
Funny enough, the cover is not, I learned this, obviously, I'm new to the world of books, but the cover is not something that I'm necessarily directly responsible for creatively. So when the publishers showed me the cover and they explained, how they got to it, the illustrator got to it, I was actually very happy because it seems like they understood quite a lot of they interpreted it in a nice way, not too literal, in a way where you could sort of like make up your mind, even if you didn't really understand what was going on. It's still aesthetically pleasing. The colors are very vibrant and beautiful. But I do think, yes, it speaks to the element of water. The element of water in the book, which is a prevalent theme, as well as family and the foliage and the natural landscapes that a lot of the characters find themselves in. So I think that they did a really good interpretation of that. I was actually surprised that that is something that they would have gone for, because I thought maybe they could have, I don't know, like, I just don't, you don't know which way in which somebody's going to interpret it, especially if you hear that, like, oh no, you can't get input in it. It's something that is like they already have somebody who designs covers for them. I was kind of skeptical, but I think it worked out great. I think it's beautiful.
So speaking of the book, I'm interested in how the book was written out, because it's a multi-character point of view. So you're seeing different people move through the book. And I think that that's one of the most challenging ways to write a book, because effectively as the author, you need to think of yourself, or you need to think of what Vuyelwethu will say versus a romance, etc. And so I find that to be quite a challenging way to write. And for your debut, I'm particularly intrigued about why you chose to have a multi-character point of view as a way to write your book.
The thing is, I love long books. Like, I love books that cover maybe like 100 years, or like I wish people would write books like that a lot more. Like, start from 1919 and then the other character goes to like 2021. I think that long span of time is always really nice to understand a point, like for somebody to make a point. And for me, that was essentially what I was thinking about. I was like, if I'm really going to make a point about the conflicted identity issues that Vuyo has in modern day life, I can't just start with her and her life right now, you know, and she comes from a people, she comes from a place, she comes, there's so many things that like build into a person that it, to me, it's almost always going to be important to draw the through line between the present day and the past, no matter how far I go in that past. It can be 100, it can be 200 years, but I always think that the past informs the present and in such a beautiful way. And I love this dialogue always between the past and the present, the past and the present, and how you basically are always in the moment of things, so you can speak about really heavy things, like, you know, you, how can I say this best? So for example, yes, I didn't live through the worst of apartheid, but how it exists in me right now and how I've consumed it and learned about it and interpreted it for progress in my life, it's still very much present. So I think that, you know, I'm informed by the things that happened back then, and I use it for the present to make the future different, but it's still very much alive. It's not like the differences of the past are gone completely in South Africa. We're still living in them. I mean, even in your intro, you were talking about corporate South Africa. You know, that switching that you do, that's obviously a part of getting integrated or learning how to be an integrated society. So yeah, that's the long way of the reason why I love long lines and long stories. And yeah, it is a difficult way, I think. I think it is difficult to write different characters because you have to be true to every single one. And people can feel when you're lying, because especially if it's about people that they know about. They can feel when you're lying. They know because they have an aunt romance in their life. They know of a couple that's mixed race, or, you know, they can feel. So it's very difficult to inhabit those worlds of the different people. But I suppose that's the challenge you put on yourself, unnecessarily so, I would say, for me.
I wanted to speak about one of the... I suppose the themes that was quite gut-wrenching for me. I remember like reading like maybe 70 pages of this, and I messaged her and I'm like, girl, nah, well, hold up. You know, you didn't tell me that I would be entering this book in this way, right? And that is grief, right? But I want to speak about the sort of different manifestations of it. And I suppose I start about with a more like kind of apparent one, right? Which is, the book is centered around Christopher, right? And Christopher passes away, and that there is that grief, but there's also not the grief of Christopher. There seems to be a grief of like, of men, right? That are attached to these women throughout the book, right? So you find that like every now and then someone loses someone, right? And so I want to speak about like grief as a theme that moves the book and moves through the book in that sense. But I also want to speak about the grief of, like, for instance, you think about the grief of people leaving, right? So the decision that his girlfriend and then wife, right? And we know later on as we go along who she becomes and who she is, the decision that she makes. And even the grief of the children that Mkholisi kills, right, at school, right? And then also the grief that I thought was quite interesting was the grief between Vuyo and her mother, right? Because in many instances, the grief of the dad passing away impacts the how the mom shows up in the relationship. And therefore, there's a grief of Vuyo feeling like, I don't have a mother who's fully present in my life. And therefore, there's a part of me that I'm not going to fully nurture, because this woman is not doing mothership the way that I think mothership should be done, right? And also, this woman is so proud about January families, what. But at the same time, she's not showing up as a January woman, right?
Yeah.
And then you think about the more sort of like punchy grief, which was the grief of losing self, right? And you think about Room Ace, who is romance, the tragic thing that happens to her. And throughout the book, it's like, she's just like a figment of herself, right? So she moves through the book, but like she's not there, but she's there, right? So I wanted to speak about that, right? So there's these different ways in which grief shows up in the book, but the different roles in which each type of grief does to the story in the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, as when I was writing the book, I was grieving my own self, the basically like the should be of my life. So that's actually the mindset that I was in, actually. Like the book has quite a lot of melancholic haze. And I think my sister was like, why'd you write a book so sad? You know, she was like, this book is sad. And I think it's because I was extremely sad. I got to my mid-20s and I thought to myself, like, this is just, you know, like life, I've imbibed the standards of what my life should be. And now I'm so confused and I'm really angry and I'm not angry at, I can't be, there's no real person whom I can say I'm angry at. Like I'm mad at life. I'm mad, you know? And so that was a very central theme that actually started, you know, the characters. And I thought, well, if it's going to be a theme, this is true for every theme that I put in the book. Every single one of them, every single character finds themselves by a body of water. Every single character faces a loss. Every single character faces a moment of redemption. So also because it's cyclical, you know, you can't be in grief forever. You know, and I don't also want to write a story like that. Like, I don't want to write a never, never tale of sadness. Like, you know, so I just decided that all the characters, this is how I'm going to show I'm not God, but like this is how this character is going to overcome their grief. They are going to use their set of circumstances and they're going to overcome it. And also I wanted to highlight how because all of these people are related, that in one family, this is how sometimes families are. Like, we're all going through similar things. Like, one thing can happen that, like, for example, Mgolisi will pass away, but we've been grieving a long time. The mother was grieving an unborn child, the Vuyo was grieving the absence of her mother since her sister was never born. You know, the father, even before he passed away, was grieving, you know, himself and the ideas that he had with his own father. But we bring this to each other in a way in which we're not telling each other, but we're relating to each other. And in this instance, one would say from the outside that this is a happy family. So how much more in a crazy, dysfunctional, overtly dysfunctional and overtly crazy, quote unquote, crazy family would such dynamics play a role, you know? And I think that was important for me to highlight that, you know, grief shows up in little and loud ways. And we take it with us. You just continue. You live. You make decisions based on it. You live. You're moving through it until at some point you find yourself by the ocean, by yourself, or you know, you find yourself really, really brought to your knees by life, and you have no other choice but to transform. And I mean, I love romance's transformation. I think that it made me the happiest because I just felt like in terms of her as a character, she was the one character who from the beginning was very content with herself, you know? So when the world crushed her, it was a new feeling for her because she'd never ever been a person. She imbibed that January propaganda and she lived it and she didn't question it and she was a part of it and it was just her. So for her to be crushed like that by life, you know, for me, I was always fighting for her to come back. And when she came back, I wanted it to be a comeback that was realistic for her sort of circumstances, but also one that like felt, made you feel like, yes, you're on her side. Like, yes, you're romance. Like, you know. And also, I think that it was important because a lot of the times people focus on romances or they meet the romances of the world, not the Nobandu. Nobandu, who she really is, who she came from, that story is often forgotten about as if like the romance, the sassy, the loud person is she came out like that. You know, that's what she's had to do to survive. But like, she's a balance of both those things, and I wanted to celebrate both those things.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
It's interesting that you've said that about romance, because I, Nozuko, I didn't feel that, and I even said that to the Tokonon. I felt like Nozuko for me is like a life interrupted, and maybe that speaks to, and this is a trigger warning, this speaks to what sexual assault does to people and the kind of trauma that people experience. So I actually felt like romance was moving through this world with like a complex, unprocessed PTSD, right? Because you see her move on. Of course, you know, there's the period where she almost becomes a shadow of herself after she experiences that assault. And then she moves away because she can never be herself or become close to what she could be in a space that constantly reminds her of what happened to her. But you see her in this place, and she's robbed of so many experiences. So I wonder, like, what it would have looked like for Nobantu to have the kind of relationships with men that we see being explored in the book, right? It's like the exploration, the failed relationships, the children, those kind of interactions. Well, she becomes the aunt that everybody loves, you know, who is like the childless aunt, who's sort of not attached to anyone and anything. But there's a backstory to that. And so, like, for me, I felt like Nobantu was a story interrupted, or was a dream interrupted. I don't know. I felt like there were elements of her personality that was so changed by the assault. And I feel like that is such an accurate representation of what sexual assaults does to some people. That's right? Perfect. That, like, and the idea that, for example, we tell people, oh, this happened 20 years ago, you assaulted 20 years ago, just get over it, is so false and is so violent and is so untrue, right? Because this is such a character molding experience that you go through, right? Trauma changes your personality. It changes what you envision for yourself. It changes what you think is possible for you. And I for me, romance was such a, she was a beautiful character, but I felt like so much of who she was also then revolved around other people. So putting up this performance of being like the sassy, got it together aunt who comes and like nurtures people and fixes people and sorts people out. And I wonder how much of that is like a defense mechanism because of what has happened to her and the ways in which she was unable to almost fix herself and defend herself and sort herself out at that particular moment when that incident occurs.
And I wanted to,
I think before you
come there, because I think it's really interesting what Alma's talking about. And I wanted to, you know, extrapolate from Nobantu's story, what she says, right? Which, like, sat with me until today. So, like, I can even remember it because just, like, the shadow of herself. So the two things. So Nobantu says, to this day, no man has ever seen me naked. And I'm certain that I would never want to be naked for anyone else but him. I am loosed, but tied to him for life. These are my vows. I'll keep them until I draw my last breath. But now I'm leaving the city. I had a sister to love and a niece who needs protection. It was exciting to know that there would be a life for me after my internal turmoil. I would embrace a different truth, one that would redeem and strengthen me throughout my coming years. I didn't know if he would ever find such peace for himself. It was no longer my problem. I had only one thing left to do, and that was to forgive him. And you think about, like, just what Alma is saying about, like, she's robbed of an entire human experience, right?
Yeah.
Because of this particular thing. But more than that, like, the trauma that she's facing is also the trauma that her sister was the one who found her in that position. And now all her life and all the time she's trying to, like, you know, she keeps saying, I don't want her to stand in the blood in the way that she stood in my blood, right? Yes. So she's not even dealing with her trauma by herself. she's like trying to make sure that everyone else is okay with being okay with that trauma and not her.
Yeah.
So the, what Alma was saying about PTSD is really important, because now she's internalizing all these things, but she has no place to process because she's trying to be strong for everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that's why, I mean, I say celebration, obviously within limits, of course, right? And yes, I agree. I think the conclusion of how she, how she ended up in life, is if you say life interrupted, yes, I would agree with that. But I think that that is the most realistic way in which you resolve that character's trauma. Because if you say that this is a book and we're lapsing moments in time in order to get to a conclusion, right? Then you skip the parts where, you know, a person cries this, that, is afraid. You skip all those parts. You get to the part where they're like talking about this person with another person, and they're talking about this event, or they're dealing with it really, and they're understanding it, and they're saying to themselves, no, I'm renaming myself, and I'm moving forward, and I'm dealing with it. So that is it's a quick fix really, but it's obviously not how it happens in real time. In real time, her story could take 50 years. In real time, her story could take, it might never even get to the point where the person is renamed Romance. Like, she might leave that place and get to Cape Town and literally live there forever and choose a path where that she just devolves and from that place of trauma all the time. So, I mean, yes, it's like a fix for a book. It's made to make a point of resolving the situation. But yes, I understand. And I agree. I agree that it's, as I said, like, Romance was, of all the characters, the one who was the most satisfied with her life. She was the one who was most affected by the world coming or cruel things happening from the outside to her. Because for her, she was so naive, even it happened how, well, she in her mind says she let it happen, you know, or it was her fault. Like, she puts it in, and every single moment that led up to that moment, she views it as herself. And even her conclusion of it is like, no, you know, when her sister chose somebody else, she was basically leaving her in that moment by herself. So it's still a thing that she feels like, no, don't leave me by myself. Otherwise, if I am by myself, then it means it's my fault. I caused it. You know what I mean? But she resolves it somehow. And I don't know. It's a difficult thing to talk about because, as I say, this is one character. This is one example. This is a way in which I'm trying to address this issue. But at the same time, it's also something that is like, in real time, you know, that is it doesn't have a perfect... It doesn't have a perfect way out. There's no, it's always going to be messy how somebody lives after this moment.
Mm.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk, I think another big theme in the book is this idea of like family, right? And you know, we are Januaries when Vuyo was going through
the propaganda.
She needed to go back and she's just like, young.
Yeah.
But often I think in like these family structures, it's like this overwhelming feeling of having to perform. And if you don't fit within the mold of what a January is supposed to be, you're sort of like pushed to the outskirts, or you become like the help of your family, right? So like, we have a shop, you are the one who will do the deliveries and you will do the what, because when you couldn't get anywhere and you will basically work your keep in this household, right? Because you didn't go to university, you didn't do this, you want mang. But closely connected with this overwhelming idea of family and like how it doesn't create space for people to move and find their own identity is also this idea that I think you try to elevate in the book, right? Often when we think about like South African stories and we think about Black people, we think about Black people who don't have money and the families come from poor environments. But what I think you also try to elevate in the book is this, that a family like January exists in a place like the Eastern Cape, right? Where they've exactly. always had like land, right? They've always had some form of like wealth that passes through the generation. So you find that like some of these people are not even working because they don't have to, because our family has money, right? And like, well, exactly. I can just go and participate in the family money. So I wanted to put those two ideas next to each other, right? The idea of like, yeah, while it's great for you to live in this idea of Black generational wealth, there's also this idea that like you are suffocating because like you are supposed to be a particular person because you are a January. And if you're not, you'll have to earn your keep to be this January.
But also to add to that, so there's also the idea that it's very particular for the woman in the January family. So there's a thing about matrilineal lineage, but also the expectations on the woman in this family are particularly suffocating. So January women have to be resilient. January women have to be strong. They have to have it together. Because if we're being honest, January men in many ways are messy, right? They are an entire mess and clingy. So they're messy, they're problematic, and the standards, the moral standards for behavior that are held up are not quite the same for January men as for January women. So I want to contrast the idea. I want to add that additional layer of what it means to, because in Black families, that's often the case, right? So the women in families are often expected to move in particular ways. So you must be the daughter that doesn't embarrass us. You must be the daughter who goes on to represent us well, because women from this family move in a particular way. And the expectations for men are often just below the ground, you know, if they exist at all. So
I'm just agreeing with you that just them existing is enough. Like you're here, you're the man. Yeah,
it's sufficient. Just be, you know. But January women must be this all encompassing. You know, you're not allowed to have mental health problems. You are not allowed to experience grief. You need to just get it together. You know, we get it together, and getting it together is what kills Black women.
You know, in my life, that is what I want people, like I want Black women to loose themselves from, the idea of we are strong. No, the idea of we are strong for me is an idea meant to keep Black people or Black women in particular and in a position of advantage. It's a way to say you can endure hard things, so we will do hard things to you, you know. And I just think that, like, I don't think that is it's not a human feeling, you know. It's not nice. It's not how I would, like, I don't want somebody to be slapping me across the face or, you know, hurting me or whatever. That's not how I want to live my life. So why do we as a group of people now, not even literally just before we're Black, before we're women, why would you want that to be happening to you, you know? And then now we take that and we wear that as a proud coat. You are strong. No, strong for what am I strong for, you know? And sometimes I wanted to, in the book, to also highlight the how community can asphyxiate a person, because we love also, you know, obviously I grew up in a huge family. So this idea of, like, you know, you're one part of a big whole, it was my, I don't know, it was what I ate every single day. And so at the end of the day, you find yourself being like, here we are in this huge, huge system. I don't even relate to half of all these people, but we're supposed to all be one part of a whole. And you're just supposed to participate even when things, you can see that, like, the people who run this machine, the people who hold it up, it's they're just running on low, but because they're supposed to, you know, carry the whole, is part of the community. If we move together, then, you know, we're going to get better every single generation. There are problems with this kind of thinking. And I think it's not challenged enough, because people say it's African, it's our culture, you know. So whenever, you know, you just like, but is this okay? Is this something that we as a community feel like, because it's always been done, or, you know, it works, or it favors a certain group of people, why rock the boat, you know? And these are ideas that I think are, we have to challenge community, because there's nothing wrong with community. I think it's great. But I think that there is something wrong when there are certain people who carry the community a lot more than other people. You know, if we're going to have roles for women that are so clearly identified and are known publicly by everybody, then let's also loudly also say what are the roles for it. And also, maybe not. That's also another thing that that sometimes I think a lot is, why? Why do we have to highlight that a man must and a woman must and children must? You know, why can't it be that we have tasks to do and whoever is fit for the task, do the task, you know? And, you know, someone will say, that's a dream world, blah, 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 you know? But this is the kind of problematic thing that happens is, yes, on one side, the highly individualistic capitalism, by yourself, bootstraps life, it has very obvious negatives, but then everybody touts, like the communities in the world that live in a communal sense always say, oh, this is a better way of life. But when you look at it, is it really? Is it, how many people in that space can talk about feeling lonely, can talk about feeling like, you know, they don't want to be married, or they don't want to live according to whatever was done by the generation before them, and be free to do so, and that choice be accepted and not be questioned and brought up as a joke every single time in the family setting? Or if you fall below the bar, you're not now going to be the person who everybody thinks, well, you're not doing anything with your life, so we're just going to use you as our lackey. You know, this is sometimes the part where it's like, yeah, you're safe, you're eating every single day, you've got a thing to do, but the community is actually the one, your own people, you can't speak out against them. You can't, there's no tribunal that you can take them to, because they protect you and they feed you and they clothe you. But so you're stuck. And so you don't have any, what I would say, literal rights in the space to speak and express yourself. And yet you feel, I don't know, like you feel aggrieved. So it's a double-edged sword, and it's hard for people to accept that there is something wrong sometimes with community. Community sometimes it's almost better to be by yourself, because at least you can guarantee peace, as opposed to, you know, like being attached to a group of people because of history, culture, language, I don't know, family.
I mean, it's also interesting to think about, like, a large part of reading the book, I thought, whoa, I wonder if the author is writing this book in his class, all right? And like, we're reading it in English, right? Because, and I wanted to speak about that, right? Like, just this idea of like, the texture and the feelings of the book is in a language that is not written in, right? Because I felt a lot of that. Like, I was like, ah, damn. Like, I wish I knew how to read isiXhosa, and this book was written in isiXhosa, because I felt like some of the sort of softer and deeper moments of the book would have come better in that texture, right? And I wanted to speak a little bit about like language, right? And also just to connect the sort of Afrikaansness of it in the book, because a lot of it is also elevating that element, right? Like, we often think about like how people speak about Afrikaans as this like kind of white language. But we think about like lots of like people and how like Afrikaans is a black language, right? And in many instances,
it is.
A lot of us are like polyglots who speak Afrikaans and who are proud of the fact that we speak Afrikaans. So I wanted to speak about that, right? The sort of texture of like writing in English, but actually writing in isiXhosa, all right? And also like weaving Afrikaans into the story and what that achieved for the reader, but also for the story.
But to add to that, also making particular decisions, Nozibo, right? So yeah. not translating, for example, particular concepts, because there are books that you can tell have been written for a particular gaze. So the author wants to almost translate their lived experiences and even the language for people who would ordinarily just not relate or not understand, right? But the book is written with a particular deliberation, in the sense that you don't do that, right? So it doesn't come across that you've wanted to translate for people who may not necessarily speak the language or who may not understand the culture. And that's a very deliberate act, right? So when you think about how books can be written, books by Black authors, sometimes people feel like they need to write for a white gaze. So for the Kilani Reading Book Club that is then going to buy your book and talk about it on a particular radio station.
Yes.
So even that is an interesting act for me.
You know, for me, it's very, very hard, the idea that, first of all, I mean, I can't write in Isixhosa. I would love to. It's my upbringing, I suppose. It's unfortunate, but I obviously grew up in a Xhosa context, and I grew up in a Xhosa colored Afrikaans context. So that is, it's my lived experience, right? And so I often enjoy when that experience is translated as if, like, you know, you added Afrikaans because you're trying to do the reconciliation thing. And I think, no, I was saying that, okay. Yeah, I was just saying that, like, for me, the exploring how Xhosa and colored people and Afrikaans and Xhosa lives side by side and how it's normal and isn't, It's not an urban thing, definitely. It's something that I saw growing up when we went to the Eastern Cape. And I just thought this in the urban setting is always so divisive, or not divisive, but like, I mean, it exists in a more divided kind of way. Like Afrikaans belongs to certain people, and they have total right to it. And then I know of a different reality, and this reality isn't necessarily almost always spoken about. And I just wanted to speak about that. And I mean, it's important to me as a writer, well, as a budding writer, to tell our stories as they are. I'm not interested in our stories becoming, you know, sort of an African story. I think there's too much of that happens, where, you know, really good books get essentialized as like, this is, if you want to know about Africa, this is the book. And I just think that we have such a wealth of writers, a wealth of writers who are very interested in telling stories as they are, you know, and really good writers, some of the East African writers, really, really good writers who come out of that part of the continent writing stories as they are for African audiences. And those who don't understand, well, you know, you'll figure it out. And so it's important. I think it's important. That's the most important thing, because if you lose that, then we're just in the global marketplace competing as, I don't know what we're actually competing as, really. I don't know, because then the book is not necessarily true to the people in South Africa. So if you, Letlhoko Nolo, and you, Alma, can't relate to my book in South Africa, no point in it making it in Los Angeles. No point. Because the point is, it's not about LA. And if somebody was writing about LA, they would write about LA. They will fit in all the complex things about Los Angeles that makes it special. So I want to write about the things that are not spoken about, or that I feel are not spoken about in my country, the things that I love and the things that I grew up around, and that I don't think people know about, or they misunderstand. Like you rightfully say, that Afrikaans is a Black language, but it's somehow morphed and belongs specifically only to a certain group of people. So, but that's also governed by history, and they enacted laws to make it that way, so we also understand that part.
So I am so intrigued by the love stories in this book. Okay, they are just messy, messy, messy romance. Two stories in particular, right? Because also the men that these women love are flawed in very real ways.
Dodgy. Those men are okay, dodgy.
Nkosi isn't dodgy though. Is Nkosi dodgy? Is he really?
Girl, Nkosi
is he really?
Is a whole. I don't want to even like. Nkosi so ofisa bana. Like he literally woke up one day.
Is he dodgy? And he was,
no, but let's talk about it. There's a conversation to be had there, because then it also means that we must accept that we've got a history that is very complex and that is very flawed. So exactly. Who you regard as a hero today would not have been a hero 20 years ago, because they bombed they bombed a particular place. No, it's true. They bombed a particular place.
Nishana is shaking his head like, no.
The children.
No, it's true. I mean, we must talk about it because who we regard as like heroes today, 30 years ago, would have been called terrorists, right? Some of your particular faves who get romanticized as being like the face of peace and all things goodness, 30 years ago were being called terrorists. And what is the cost of freedom? Yeah. What is the cost of freedom, and what does it look like? So he's flawed. Is he an amazing person? Is he a good person who does bad things? Yes. And that's a conversation that we can have. But I don't know that we can just essentialize the conversation to he's bad because he did X at a particular point in his life. Christopher, on the other hand, I think Christopher important. Is trashy.
Christopher is a bad man. Christopher is a bad man.
He's predatory.
Yes, I'm always in agreement with everybody. Anybody who even reads the book and says, oh, but he was, I was like, nah. No.
Is this why he drowns, Nuzuko? Because I was hurt. Okay, so I must be honest. I'm like a dodgy character, because I thought Christopher was like, you know, I was like, Christopher's such a mess. Okay, but when he drowned, I was very upset at you, Nuzuko, because I was like, who does this and why would you do this? You know, so I am very conflicted. I must be honest, Little Konolo. I know you're judging me, which is fine. I don't care. Nobody can judge me. Only God can judge me. But
Christopher deserves what he got. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, Christopher, I don't know about that. Christopher deserves what he got, but did Vuyo deserve what Christopher's drowning meant?
That's what about the gripe that I have with
Nozuko. Is that why he drowned? I don't know.
Is that why you drowned him? On a serious note, though, the question really for me is around why you wrote such complicated love stories for the January woman, you know, because it felt like at every single generation, none of them could catch a break romantically, you know. So if it's not romance experiencing assault at the hands of her lover, it is Nkolisi being, you know, an anti-hero according to the, but then also then dying so tragically, right, in ways that really fundamentally alter the relationship between his wife and his child. But then also Vuyo experiencing the death of a spouse when she is 8 months pregnant with twins, and it's like at every single generation, January women romantically can't get a break, but they also love these deeply flawed problematic men who just do a lot for free. So I'm very interested in the love stories, in this book, but also the added elements of interracial dating, because there's a thing about Christopher being an older white man who decides to date Vuyo and the trajectory of their relationship.
I also like the wit in which you made the interracial relationships work, right? Because there's a whole conversation about like, why are you marrying me? You know, my dad thinks you're racist, da 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 da, and he says, I have black friends, right? And like, truth, like, I know you made that in jest because Christopher gave a deeper reason about why he would get married.
Yeah.
But you are right. Like, there are people who would be like, because I have black friends, my babes, like let's get over it. But I suppose connected to Alma's question about the messy, right? It's also, hear me out, a rejection of more functional loving, right? So you find Sakile, right, who shows up in the book, and Sakile, for all intents and purposes, is like a perfect person, an archery. Yeah. The parents love him. He shows up at very crucial moments in Vuyo's life and is there and is present. Yes. But Vuyo is like, nah, I want messy. I want passion. I want this. So I wanted to speak about that, right? So the stories are about like these women who make decisions to be with these men who are viewed as problematic and are messy. But there's also a disavow, in truth, of Vuyo, of Sakile, who can offer sort of more sustainable loving, if you can call it that, right? So I wanted to
want to date Sakile, though? Like, be honest.
I wouldn't.
Sakile, I don't even know. Like, Sakile is problematic. Felt like, you know, at that point you were criticizing the nice guy trope. I was here for it, right? Because Sakile is this nice guy and he like moves in particular ways that just make him nice, right? And he almost weaponizes that I'm a good guy, I'm nice. What kind of existence would that have been?
Which is also very patronizing. It's very patronizing.
Be honest, even you wouldn't want Sakile to talk about safe love. What do you think about Sakile? No, he was problematic.
I'm a nice guy. Things played out. Like, please come to the table with more than I'm a nice guy. Please, no.
But can I tell you?
You can't even be held accountable, right? Because you are a nice guy. You are a good person. Oh my gosh, you are just so supportive. Please be human, right? And give me space to also then be human, because now I can't even be human, because how dare I sit at the altar of niceness and not just bow in like reverence
and spice and all things nice. No,
and Sakile had to go. He had to go.
Sakile had to go. He's like, my favorite had to go. And good luck to him. He's probably off like having a nice life with his nice girlfriend somewhere else, but he had to go. Like, or maybe he even gained a little bit of something just to, you know, I don't know, like,
just stop being a self-righteous human. He just became a person, and he realized he ain't all that in the shop. He ain't all that.
Haters, hater man. But you know what was really fascinating about the Sakile character is that even like romance could not be herself, because as much as we're talking about the nice guy, there was also a hint of like sensitivity. Like, he would not have been able to take a joke as a joke, right? It would like be quite serious, right? But it was fascinating, because I'm not necessarily saying that Vuyo I'm just saying there was a rejection of what seemed like a better option in the eyes of society.
I understand exactly what you mean. The importance with at the end of the is why like the whole everybody goes through what they go through, because Vuyo determines to herself that this will not be their life. Like, she goes there and performs a ritual to say goodbye to accepting, you know, like, not knowing who I am, so not knowing what I deserve. And so I think that is the through line between the women. Like, the women of January have been loved for being sassy and spicy and resilient and all of these things, but perhaps in the new generation, this is not what we must be known for. We can still be beautiful, and we can still celebrate everything about us that moves us forward, but it doesn't have to be rooted in things that like cause so much pain or you know, are rooted in pain, and then we go and we fight for them. I mean, the mother literally had a nice life. Will's mother had a nice life, and she decided for herself, like, no, of all the guys that I could find in the world, let me just hang on to this raggedy bit over here, you know, because she just thought her life was a little bit too, like, a little bit too comfortable, you know, and that was her revolution. Are you mad? Like, are you serious? You know, and I think that it's this kind of thinking. I just want to say, Nozuko,
it's when he was walking into the felt after the fire that she said, I want this man.
Isn't that a metaphor for life, though? Like, how many red flags have you
seen? That is exactly how it happens.
How many red flags have you seen, and you just thought it was a carnival? Come now. Like, you're like, it's just a carnival. But we have to talk about Christopher and Vuyo, guys. It will actually be, it will be remiss for us not to speak about Christopher and Vuyo.
I love how she said, I drowned him.
You drowned him, and it's okay. Sis, own it. You drowned Christopher.
What
it's okay.
He deserved. Yeah, what he deserved.
Honolo, you are so trashy in this moment for that comment. But I forgive you. It's okay. I will release you spiritually. They must
it's
be honest.
About
they
what, it's about this moment when Vuyo is about to finish her law degree. Mm-hmm. And this Christopher sits her down and says, I don't think it's going to work out. You want to get someone to marry one day, and I can't give you that.
So, but it's the truth. Yeah. Also, Vuyo wasn't unaware of the situation. And I think that this is
exactly
the point, right?
Exactly. Vuyo she walked
into a situation where she knew that this older white man was her professor. He was married, and she knew about the nature of their relationship. And there is an agency that she exercised in walking into it.
Exactly.
And also, Christopher gave her the truth. He said, I'm married, I'm not in a position to give you what you want. And like, there is an honesty. Sometimes love is honesty. I can see what you want. I can't give you what you want, and I can release you. You can then decide if you want to continue or not. So Vuyo was not a passenger. Vuyo was driving that.
And you accept, if you accept what I say, that this is what you get, you can get, you then must also take responsibility for all the emotions that flow from you.
Exactly.
Because you know that's all you're going to get.
What about Christopher's wife? Like, why is not catching feelings? About the fact that Christopher's wife. What about Christopher's wife? So now we're all like, oh my gosh, you know, Christopher's so trashy.
Yeah.
She was a willing participant. She stepped into that situation. She was very happy when it suited her, and the terms of engagement suited her. When the terms of engagement no longer worked for her, now there is like this pain that we must feel, and this compassion.
Yeah.
Where was the compassion in the beginning when she was initiating the terms of engagement? Like,
yes. Yes.
Christopher's and trashy, so is Vuyo. She's trashy. They were trashy. That's why it worked.
The funny thing is that there are people who have like spoken to me about the book and who will make as if like Vuyo, wow, like her man treated her. And I'm like, no. Do not be under the illusion that a 22-year-old girl with a flat stomach and a nice body and very aware of how she looks doesn't have agency. She has complete agency. She knows exactly what she's doing. And so at the end of the day, she thought her beauty and her thing was a novelty. And she thought also it was power, you know? Mm. And so this is also part of her upbringing, where you just take what you can, because what are you? You're a January woman. Nothing stands in your way, right? Like, you can get whatever you want to the detriment of everybody else. And even more than that, now not only are you a January woman who's been raised by this woman who has this sort of fire and revolutionary spirit, your dad also spoils you. So where are the limits here to your life? There are no limits. So of course a married man is exactly who you're gonna want. That's exactly who you're going to want. You're going to want a white, highly educated from the top university. And you're going to just be like, I dethroned the wife and I got him. And what do you get? A drowned husband.
You get Christopher. But also, this is not to ignore the power differentials, right? So it's not to ignore that this was a highly inappropriate relationship. Christopher held a position of power by the fact that he was older, he was highly educated, he was somebody that she deferred to a lot. And this is not to ignore those power dynamics, but it's also to say she had agency in the situation. And there's a thing about denying women agency in the situation because we don't agree with them. That we need to be careful of, right?
But I think
and you know, they loved each other. Oh, you know, was it perfect?
That's also very true.
No, they loved each other. It was sad that Nozugo drowned him. It was
what he deserved.
Wow.
So for me,
hurt by his drowning, Nozugo and little I don't care what you guys say. I am hurt by his drowning. Was he trashy? Was he problematic? Yes, I'm still hurt by his drowning.
Did he drown?
I'm so sorry.
This is the hill I'm dying on. Why did he drown, Nozugo? Why did you drown him?
Because he had to go. He had to go somehow. And I didn't know. I mean, anything else below everybody else. I mean, Ntolisi had the girls and the bombing, and you know, Romance had her tragic situation. So the only thing that left was water. So I don't know.
But why did he have to drown? I'm really invested in this, guys. I'm sorry. Why did he have to drown? And I'm interested in that as a point of character development, because I think when you think about how their relationship started, he was somebody that Vuyo deferred to a lot. He was almost this like father figure in ways that we see a lot of times when younger women marry men who are particularly older and positioned in particular ways in society. And I think that when he drowned, Vuyo came into her own in ways that she would not had she always had him
she
as a shelter.
Never.
It was like a continuation of the father-daughter relationship, but with them. And I think that in romantic situations, that's always interesting to witness. So I understand why you drowned him, but I'm still hurt.
I'm sorry.
What I wanted to say, Nozuko, is that you made a very important point about Vuyo, right? And like sort of this genuineness and this arrogance. Because remember, there's a scene where she finds one of Saikile's friends masturbating in Saikile's bathroom.
He says,
obviously he's masturbating to the idea of me, right? Like the fact that he
exactly
hit me, right? And can so you are right about the idea that, like, in many instances, I think she was cut not by the fact that she wasn't going to date Christopher, but she was cut by the fact that, like, I've had this man for 4 years and now suddenly he decides that he can't have me. Like, how dare he, right? And
yeah,
I mean, girl, I know.
I think all of them were governed by, from inception, besides romance, all of them were governed by wrong thinking. Because, well, maybe even romance as well, you know, because had she not had her experience, she would have been, I don't doubt, one of those aunts that finds herself with there in the rural areas. She would have grown up and become one of them, like those ones that just shout and just, you know, they're hitting everyone and anything and, you know, like better abide by the rules. So I think it's kind of wrong thinking. It's the wrong thinking of thinking that, like, you know, we're born this way. This is who we are. Being a January is not a personality. It's your surname. It's your surname. So you don't have to find a way to build legend like into your surname just because the legend exists around, you know? And I think that all of them betray themselves in this way, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's also what leads to the mess, because nobody in life can live without limits. You there's no such thing. You can't be this huge boundless thing and you take whatever you get everything that you want to the detriment of everybody else. And I think that is the humbling, all of them, like that is life dealing with them, but it's also part of their wrong thinking that they have to heal. They have to understand that life is talking to them through the thinking that they have, that they own. So yeah, that was part of it.
I wanted to spoil the last part of the book, but you know what? Because I love the Cheeky Natives, I'm going to get the book and just be shocked as I am about the last situation. Because just before the podcast, I said,
Nozuko, we have to talk offline because that was like the source of some trauma for me.
Okay.
We will talk offline about it.
So, Nozuko, I suppose before we go, what do you hope Christopher will achieve? And what dreams do you have for Christopher who drowned?
You know, I just like, Jesus is watching you, okay? Jesus is watching you. That's all I'm going to say.
I am, you know, a debut novelist. I've always wanted to write. I'm an avid reader. So I would hope that the way in which books like Sue and, you know, like, I don't know, books like that, like books that have literally inhabited my soul for many, many years, that I go back to and I read lines of, that I quote, and I say, I hope it lives like that in other people, you know, that, because for me, really, when I wrote that book, I really was saying goodbye to whoever I thought I was going to be since I was 15 years old, you know, like I had one track mind about my life, until I decided that no, life is open and it's limitless and you can change your mind and find yourself being somewhere else in a couple of years after you've changed your mind. And I think that for me, Christopher was just a testament to say, I can change my mind and I don't have to be what generations before me have been. And that's a brave thing to do. I hope it makes people brave. I hope it makes them be like, yes, I see everything that I've been given, but I want something else. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Nozuko. It's been absolutely a wonderful...
Sure, that's such a timely way to end it. I see what everybody else has said, and this is what I want for my life, right? And what a declaration, right? Because that's an act, that's a revolutionary act for a lot of Black people to say, I see what has been the societal standard and I choose something different unapologetically.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean,
in the wise words of Maxine Water, reclaiming my time, reclaiming
amen. Thank you so much, Nozuko, for really what is such a powerful conversation. I think I have forgiven you for drowning Christopher. I'm at a place
Nozuko, I support your decisions. I support your decisions. I just want to
know. I have forgiven. I'm actually, after this conversation, I've forgiven Nozuko for drowning Christopher. But it really is to thank you for such a powerful book. I think, you know, there's something about writing the kind of debut that makes people want to have conversations around your book, and we can't wait to see what's next. We can't wait to see what book comes next. We know that this will not be the last one, and we really are just wanting to extend a lot of gratitude to you and to wish you all the best, and we're super excited to have you on the Cheeky Natives again in the future with your next book.
I will be so glad. Thank you. That's all I can say. And thank you for also like waking up in the morning. I know, we had a good time. I was kind of, the whole morning I was literally freaked out, because I was like, you know, when you really, really want something, sometimes it can go a little bit weird. And yeah, I was just hoping that the vibe was right, and the vibe was right.
Thank you so much, Zuko, for, I suppose, firstly writing Christopher, but also being so open and candid with us about some of the decisions you made with the characters. I think it's really important oftentimes to get in behind, it's like the behind the scenes, right, in many instances, yes. To be like, okay, this is why I made this decision, and this, even this decision hurt me, right, or this decision surprised me. So thank you again, you natives. We want to encourage you again to get Christopher, which is published by Jacana Media, which is written by Nozuko. And I mean, we can hook you up if you want us to, you know, get you a copy. You can just email us and say, hey, y'all, I listened to the podcast. I love this book. Can you hook me up? And then, you know, the Cheeky Merchant will come through for you at your doorstep. But again, thank you for supporting us. Please, please, like, what we encourage you to do is listen to the podcast and leave a comment and say, oh, I love this. Oh my gosh, Nozuko's laugh is fantastic. Yes, Nozuko, on this. Yes, Alma, I also support you in forgiving the Tokonolo. You know, just engage with the podcast. But thank you once again. And again, until next time, Cheeky Natives, we love you and we appreciate you. So please. Until next time, bye.